Hi, my name is Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right Senator Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Natalie. Good morning, Shireen. Good morning, everybody.
Shireen Gorbani on the left. Hi, Shireen.
Hello. And hey, listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
I want to start out today's program by talking about the World Health Organization and this vaccine gap between rich and poor nations. The World Health Organization, at least a representative from the World Health Organization, is calling it a moral outrage that wealthy countries are able to vaccinate their entire population while healthcare workers, older people, and others at high risk are going unvaccinated in poorer nations. Dan, what should the U.S. do here? I mean, we have to take care of our own. I mean, we've got to take care of our people, but we do have some vaccines we can share as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can see that as a country, you know, the president said, let's roll it out for everybody in April, if I remember right. Now we're talking, you know, in Utah, we're exceeding that deadline because we have so many young people really here as a state. We're a very young state. And so you can kind of see that we're rolling into it faster than even other states are. The interesting part when you look at kind of the global perspective of dealing with coronavirus and how it impacts their economies and how it impacts like their populations, it is tough to take a vaccine away from a very small, locally dense population and push it out to kind of a more agrarian society or whatever it might be. So I can understand that difficulty. I'm glad at the end of the day that's not a decision that I have to make. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shireen, you probably saw the U.S. committed some vaccines sharing with our neighbor to the south, Mexico.
Yeah. You know, I think that this is really tied into the larger conversation that we've been having this whole time about what really is going to get us back to some sense of normalcy when we have these disrupted global supply chains, when we have countries, dozens of countries that haven't seen any vaccine yet. It makes it difficult to get ahead of variants. It really continues to create complex problems for everybody. So I think that this is a place where we really should be pushing for open source information on these vaccines. I think that we should be pushing them to places where they can be produced in a way that is much more equitable. And frankly, we're having issues with equity here in our own state and across this country as well. So there's a lot of room for improvement here. I will just say I often think about how truly being born in the United States is winning the jackpot. And this is another example of it, even though there are many places where we could improve. We are very lucky to live where we live.
Let's stay with you for just one second here, Shireen. I noted that we're getting about 28,000 vaccines a day in the state of Utah. This week, Governor Cox signed HB 294. This is the bill that would lift the statewide mask mandate, except for large gatherings. We're in a race between the vaccine and the variants. How do you read this right now?
Yeah, this is still a really precarious situation. Right now, I think, you know, many of us live in bubbles, right? And the bubble that we live in, I think, is really shaping our perception of exactly what's happening and, frankly, what we determine is science and what isn't and many other things related to this pandemic. But only about 15% of Salt Lake County is fully vaccinated at this point. That is a huge gap in terms of what we need for herd immunity, even with the numerous Utahns who have gotten coronavirus and likely have antibodies. So we are in a moment where I just would really plead with people to continue to follow the health guidelines, continue to mask. We are so close to getting ahead of this. I hope that we can.
Dan, what are you telling your constituents?
Well, I think everybody needs to continue to be responsible. And, you know, you still see, our case count staying, you know, largely flat to dropping. And I think that's a success for a lot of reasons. But, you know, we also have a lot of good that we can still do in our community by bringing the economy back and by kind of, you know, pushing things forward. One thing I will say, you know, everybody's worried about the risk, but remember, we have taken most of the risk pool and they're getting vaccinated now, right? And so the most at-risk people have been vaccinated, past tense. And so now what you're talking about is you're talking about a lower risk population. And, you know, you're going to start to see the deaths obviously start to trend down as the number of cases. Even if they increase, you're still going to see deaths trending downward. And I think that is enough there when you look at how that all interacts to say, look, let's make some smart decisions. By all means, if you don't feel comfortable, stay home. If you have the ability, wear a mask, you know, do those things. But at the same time, it's time to get this thing going, right? And mm-hmm. and try to push society forward. And really, this is going to take some time to recover from. And I'm not looking to slow that down. And neither are the constituents that I'm hearing from.
I'm so curious about what you think in our economy is not open. I've been hearing this argument here and there in Utah. And really, I feel like so many sectors of our economy have opened back up. And I really, again, would just reiterate, it is a critical moment for people to take the health recommendations seriously. We are so close. We really are.
Well, I would say the things that I think people think we're freer than we are right now, right? You still have the ability, you know, during states of emergency or everything else, you still have OSHA going in and inspecting employers' places of business to check for masks. You still have, I mean, you go down the list of if you want to go to Nevada or drive through to California or whatever it might be, there are stipulations and requirements that you have to do planning to travel.
Okay, but what does that have to do with what we have closed in our economy here in Utah?
On how you're going to participate in those things. And so I would say, yeah, while some people are super happy about all those restrictions, I'd say I'm not one of those, and I'm kind of looking forward to getting them all behind us.
And those aren't here in Utah, but okay, let's keep going.
Well, let's go to another tough topic. I do want to say, though, from the political middle, I'm true to the middle here in the sense that I like that you can still wear masks if you want to, and private businesses can still require masks. And we're not through this yet, so let's see this through. Let's get to the end.
But you could always wear a mask. I mean, you could wear a mask today. You could wear a mask tomorrow. You can wear a mask next year. You can always wear a mask. Like, that is never a restriction that someone should take away the option to, right? But I don't think that we should have the option where people can, you know, get criminal penalties or lose their business
Which
or whatever
we don't
it might
have right
be
now.
For not wearing one.
Yeah.
The topics are going to get easier. We're going to go to Boulder, Colorado right now.
This is not easier. Yeah.
This is not easier. 10 lives lost, grocery store in Boulder, Colorado, bringing up issues of gun control. It will take us right into talking about the filibuster. But would you like to reflect on this for just a minute, Shireen? There's a lot of calls mounting to enact gun control legislation.
Yeah. And, you know, this, of course, on the heels of a horrendous shooting in Georgia as well. And thinking about the larger context here, the one of the things that I find so incredibly frustrating, of course, is this is a complex problem. We are clearly dealing with a mental health crisis in this country. And as a person who's a deep and undying advocate for access to healthcare and mental health care being a part of that, I do think a lot about that. I also know that when we look at research around this country of how people feel about, you know, common sense gun reform, many people agree, even in a red state like Utah, on things like closing the loopholes on background checks. Gun sense and gun safety is something that actually we can find a lot of common ground on. But I think we're just not going to see any common sense or common ground from Republicans in Congress on this.
Mm. Dan, there's two things that are pushing the filibuster. It's the voting rights, and then it will be gun control. I have long been a critic of the filibuster. It used to be used sparingly. Now it's commonplace. It's this tactic that overthrows the business of the Senate. The U.S. is the only legislative body in the world that requires a supermajority for ordinary laws. I like supermajorities for veto overrides, for impeachment, for ratifying treaties, for constitutional amendments. But I don't think we need this cloture vote, this two-thirds for the normal act of business. So I know that I'm going out there a bit, Dan, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And what would you predict? Do you think that the filibuster will be thrown over because of the mood of the country right now?
So I want to stay on that topic, but at the same time, go back to Colorado. So I'll just say the cloture vote, I understand, like, the desire to be, you know, to do things differently, and, you know, to want to innovate, to change. I would say that there are several things that, you know, if you give one swing of a political pendulum, which tends to happen, you know, every 6 years or whatever, and it, you know, turns so dramatically, in this situation, it turned, you know, to the Democrat side. I think that they should be loath to get rid of the idea of the cloture vote. I don't know one thing in my life that isn't regulated already. And the idea of DC getting more stuff done does not terribly sound that exciting to me. I honestly think that most of the solutions that we're going to need to move America forward and to move Utah forward are decisions we're going to make here in Utah and have very little to do with DC. And unfortunately, though, DC tends to weigh in with a heavy gun, with a brunt force in some ways, and kind of push their agenda or whatever it might be. And we are victim to the pendulums one way or the other. So I would just say, you know, Congress not getting anything done creates better solutions at the local level. So in a lot of ways, I want to see the filibuster last through both the Democratic and the Republican majorities. It doesn't matter. Leave it alone.
Until the state legislature usurps local power, which they tend to do all the time. So this argument, I mean, tends to land a little bit disingenuous to me. But I think when we're talking about, in particular, the issue of,
Shireen,
of,
we're
again,
a state
common
of 3 million people. San Diego has more people than Utah does. Let's not get lost
Let's
in the fact
Let's just come back
that
to this
California
issue of common sense.
Has
common
many
sense interventions around gun control.
Utah.
We're just not going to see them because your party's not interested in solutions.
That's fine. Don't get in this. The legislature is just like Congress. No, we're like a super city council when you compare us to the things that go on in California and its size. I'm not lost on who we are.
I can understand why it's an upsetting read to you.
3 million, 3.5 million people. We're going to grow. Nothing against it. But so is San Diego. And they have 7 people running the city of San Diego. We have 104 plus a governor. I would just tell you, like, the idea that this statewide tyranny is ruining things, I'm not there. I don't see it.
Yeah, well, you get to be part of it.
Hey, we'll take some more of this up in the second segment. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I didn't get to hear from you, though, Dan, in our last segment. Are you pro-filibuster?
Yeah, I say leave it in place.
Okay. Yeah, and what about you, Shireen?
No, I'm ready for it to go.
Ready for it to go. Okay, well, we'll have to watch.
Before our listeners lose their mind, I would just say I did have to go back and correct, because San Diego is like 1.4 million, the city, but the county is 3.3 million. So there you go.
I feel like what I hear you saying is you want to be on a city council.
No, I haven't
said. Hey, well, let's jump into a couple of other interesting issues. This Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, it looks like his controversy continues. He was controversial in the Trump administration. In the Biden administration, it looks like they might throw out the whole Board of Governors of the United States Postal Service because they're the ones that have the sole power to remove DeJoy from his job. Shireen, did you follow this one at all?
So I am not entirely up on exactly what is happening in this moment, but I do know that there is a deep desire among the left to see Louis DeJoy gone from that role. I think there's a bigger question here and really a deep concern about what the future of the USPS looks like. There are so many people across the state in very remote areas that rely on mm-hmm. our very effective and very efficient postal system, making sure that they get things like medication or their ballots on time, for example. And we've got a lot, I think, of room for improvement and investment here, and that's what I'd like to see.
If I was behind the scenes, I would say pick your battles and don't pick trying to reduce post office hours, increase postage prices, and slow down mail delivery. I mean, I'd not go there. There's other things in the federal government I'd go after first. Dan?
Yeah, you know, I look at all of that stuff, and it is kind of like a weird fight to pick in D.C., but it seems like DeJoy's, you know, good or bad, and I'll let other people make the decision. My mom was worked at the post office. My grandpa was a postman. Like, you know, it's part of our family. But, you know, the idea that this guy seems to be on a one-man steer the plane into the side of the mountain, you know, is an interesting position to be in. And obviously it puts Biden in a tough spot because, unfortunately, he's having to focus on this, which is not part of his 100-day plan. At least last I checked, it wasn't.
Yeah, for sure. I'll tell you something else that's probably not part of his 100-day plan, and I'll specifically speak in our state, but the rising gas prices. And they are particularly a sharp increase in Utah, 28 cents more per gallon than the national average, fifth highest gas prices in the nation, Dan.
Well, and you can't send the messages that we have been sending that fossil fuels are going to die and, you know, those kinds of things, and not expect gas prices to go up. And I like a little piece of me looks at the conspiracy of it and says, let's see, I wonder if every time a Democratic president is going to be elected, if we're going to see gas prices go up, and then every time a Republican president's elected, we're going to see gas prices go down. And I wonder if the American voter is going to start making a choice on what they want their gas price to be.
Yeah. Shireen, what do you read into this? Because, you know, President Biden has done some things that have really tightened supply. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So this is a supply and demand issue, right? And I think we're also seeing something very interesting and unusual happening right now. So I know this is a little slightly off of this, but also on it. The Suez Canal is blocked right now. And my understanding is that there are many, many tankers, some carrying oil, right, that are waiting to get through. If you have not seen this, there is a live map where you can go and look. It is absolutely wild, but there is a full-on giant boat stuck across the Suez Canal.
Hmm. Wow.
And you want to talk about constraining gas prices even more, right?
Right.
That's only going to constrain supply, and as you constrain supply, but let's not lose fact of the things that the Biden administration has done specifically here in our own backyard, how it touches locally, right? The fact that there will be no new lease renewals or anything like that from, you know, fossil fuels and at least specifically for oil here in Utah, like that is a death knell to the east side of the state. And at the same time, right, it's going to restrict supply, which is driving gas prices up. So
there are also predictions that this is a temporary issue. And it sounds like the prediction is they do anticipate that it's coming down in the coming months.
Dan, I would note that eastern Utah before this would have been the most challenged area of the state. The tale of two Utahs, the rural recession, the silent recession. Any map of unemployment rates by county or, you know, macroeconomic indicators by county shows eastern Utah in a different world than much of the rest of the state.
Yeah.
Just staying on this theme, so the University of Utah took a step this week to move towards divesting in fossil fuels. The U has a $1 billion endowment, and the Academic Senate wants to more closely align the investments of that endowment with the values of the school. Oh, boy, this is going to be a tricky one. Shireen?
Yeah, so I will say at the same time, right, we see the University of Utah doing really incredible things at the local level in terms of diversifying, the energy portfolio, doing really good work to, we see the Forge site and many other ways that we're investing in solar. So I would say we are living those values and in many direct ways. As a person who works in facilities, I can tell you that. This divestment move, I think, is the right thing to do, but it is also, it seems very complicated, but I'm proud that we're looking at it.
Dan, I'm going to put on my best Shireen hat and remind our listeners that the U is going to have a virtual town hall meeting on April 12th where you can comment on this.
Yeah,
but
thanks.
Unlike Shireen, I don't have the address or phone number or anything else.
Shireen would have created a local URL that you could go and check into as well. So, you know, just check yeah. Shireen's timeline.
Dan, how will the legislature view a step like this?
Well, I think the things that the U does to make the U sustainable, I mean, there are a lot of things that that higher ed needs to do across the board to make higher education more sustainable. And so finding ways to do that without raising tuition and, you know, being focused on the demand side of college education is important. I just found out about it tonight. So trying to figure out how that works will be very interesting.
Yeah. Dan, we talked a little bit about this last week, but I'd love to hear a week update on this. The American Rescue Plan Act, it's being called ARPA, but this is the new stimulus monies. Looks like the state government will receive about $1.5 billion. What is the mood on Capitol Hill for how to spend that money, and what kind of strings are attached?
Well, the nice thing is we're out of session, right? And so we're going to have to sit there and try and figure out how this goes and kind of plot our way through what to do. I mean, really, this massive cash infusion for a state, honestly, and I can say this with a straight face, that actually doesn't need the money, right? And that's kind of the weird thing about this whole deal. But I think you're going to see what I think the Biden administration intends with this, and Congress intends, is you're going to see massive investments in infrastructure. And I think that will be the legacy from some of this. I'm mm-hmm. worried a little bit about the legacy also being, you know, inflation and what comes as a result of, you know, spending this kind of money. But for now, let's just figure out the projects we can invest in and I guess try to make the best of it when we get the inflation side of things.
Spend as much as you can. Shireen, you must have a list or you've got a chance to lobby at least one legislator here on this program. How would you like to see the state use this money?
Oh, well, I'm always going to be an advocate for, of course, investing in healthcare. We had the opportunity to fund children's healthcare, and that's one of the things I would love to see.
And Shireen, keep in mind one time, right? So
yeah.
They're going to be very careful not to spend this on an ongoing expenditure. But so if in one time in healthcare, do you know what you do one time?
So in healthcare, that would be more complicated. But I think from a very basic perspective that I would be making massive investments in affordable housing.
Okay. I'll tell you, in healthcare, what I'd be doing is shoring up public health, whether it's information technology, some of the baseline systems that deal with labs and testing, surveillance. But that would be a place to go.
Yeah.
And I'm with you, Shireen, on affordable housing.
Yeah.
Or housing affordability on the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. This might seem a little bit trivial, but I want to ask you guys what you think about James Huntsman, the son of the late Utah industrialist philanthropist John Huntsman Sr. He's filed a federal lawsuit against the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to recover millions of dollars donated to the worldwide faith in tithing. Even just the statement of donating millions of dollars in tithing puts him in a very different category than most people. Who wants to comment on this one first? I won't pick a favorite here.
I'll just say that I think this lawsuit stands no chance of surviving the initial scrutiny of, you know, were you defrauded into the money? Were you forced to give it? Were you coerced or were any of those things, right? At the end of the day, this is a willing donation from a willing party to a willing recipient. And, you know, the idea that you could go back and look at 25 years worth of donations and ask for your money back, that's ridiculous. I mean, I'll just say it. And honestly, I think Mother Huntsman, daughter of Elder David B. Haight, is probably frustrated. And I'm certain her father will have words when they reunite.
So I think that
Shireen,
the thing that I'm understanding is that it feels like from what I've read, that this is an individual who feels like he did not have the information that we had after the leak in the Washington Post about the financial holdings of the church. And that, I think, is an interesting approach. I'm a little outside of this one. I'm not really sure what to say other than I can't imagine this would hold up.
Shireen, I watched the Murder Among the Mormons Netflix documentary about Mark Hoffman.
Yeah.
Even in that documentary, they talked about the LDS Church as one of the wealthiest churches in the country.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would stand that James Huntsman didn't know that the church had a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But
Time Magazine reported it back in 1997 that the church's net worth was over $1 billion, you know, was several billion dollars, right? So back to the time of the original investment. Or his original investment in tithing, it's been always said that the church was doing well. And I'm grateful the church is doing well.
I worked a lot on, Downtown Rising, City Creek Center, when I worked at the Salt Lake Chamber. And mm-hmm. I remember, you know, being quite evident to me that the LDS Church was paying cash for City Creek Center.
Yeah.
The LDS Church does not borrow money. He knows the church has money. But okay.
So then what's the point?
Let's go to Senator Romney for a minute. The Family Security Act, getting a lot of attention. This is an act that would provide a monthly cash benefit for families. It's like $350 a month for a young child, $250 for a school-age child. It's really renewing a commitment to American families. Shireen, I think you would like it because it immediately would lift 3 million children out of poverty in this country and provide quite a bridge to the middle class without adding a dime to the federal deficit. So
yeah.
Shireen, you can go first on this.
So yes, a fan of what we are doing to invest in our children, what we can do to reduce the trauma that kids experience, whether it's hunger or the stress that's caused from a family that just simply cannot make ends meet. Those dollars go further for the rest of their lives. It's a great idea.
Dan, your take on Senator Romney's latest actions.
Well, of course, you know, everybody wants to talk about all the great benefits that come from it. But remember what he's doing here. He is going to pay for the program by making you pay taxes on what you're currently paying your taxes to state and local, your state and local taxes. So it comes with a, it's a funding, it's a new entitlement program with, it's a funding program that's exempting taxes that you're already paying. So anyway. I hate it.
We need to close it there, but I have to say he does have some spending offsets. He eliminates the TANF program and has some changes in the SNAP program. So, hey, this has been a great program. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center with Shireen Gorbani on the left, Dan McKay on the right. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everyone, for listening.